This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Monday, October the 18th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Coming up on the show today, Michelle McQuigg of the Canadian Press recaps the news that made headlines this past weekend. Mark Aflalo of Double Tap TV will tell you about today's Unleashed Apple event. Digital accessibility specialist Denis Boudreau continues our discussion on design and inclusion. And in the Western Regional Report, Jim Crisco tells you about an inclusive playground in High River, Alberta. We'll also be joined by film reviewer Kim Thistle, who will share her thoughts on the Netflix documentary Britney vs. Spears. Busy show coming your way here on a Monday. Thank you for making time to be with us wherever you are and whenever you happen to be listening. Let's begin the show with our top story of the day, an update on COVID-19, beginning with the case numbers. Currently in Canada, there are 34,985 active cases of COVID-19. And since the beginning of the pandemic in Canada, 28,493 people have died as a result of COVID. All Ontarians vaccinated against COVID can now download their enhanced certificate, which includes a QR code. Steve Henniger has more.
Ontario residents can download the enhanced vaccination certificate through the province's COVID-19 website. Under Ontario's vaccine certificate program, only those who've been fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or have a valid medical exemption from a doctor can access certain settings, such as theaters, gyms, nightclubs, and restaurant dining rooms. The enhanced system officially takes effect on Friday, but Ontarians can get their new vaccine certificates before then, and businesses can start using a new app to verify those codes. Steve Henniger, the Canadian Press, Toronto.
Over to Manitoba, two personal care homes in Manitoba's Southern Health Region are so short-staffed that family members are being asked to help take care of their loved ones. Carol Durkin, whose 98-year-old mother lives in the Salem home, says a staff shortage is partly due to people who are not getting COVID-19 vaccines. Salem Home and Tabor Home say they are working to ensure adequate staffing is in place. A senior military commander says the Canadian Forces will be enforcing mandatory vaccinations for its members. Ottawa has announced a new mandatory vaccine policy that will require federal public servants, including RCMP workers, air travel and rail employees, and travelers to be fully vaccinated against COVID by the end of the month. Brigadier General Bill Fletcher, the commander of Western Canada's 3rd Canadian Division, says planning has been in the works for a while.
And we'd already been dealing with the implication for deployments and employment of non-vaccinated folks going into a COVID hot environment or going into an international setting where the host country has said, you will be double vaccinated. So we've already, had some experience navigating those waters, and now it's those folks need to ultimately make a decision on whether they'll be vaccinated.
Fletcher says those opposed make up a small percentage of personnel. Vaccine passports are emerging as the latest challenge for restaurant workers across the country. Don Kelly explains.
Many front-of-house staff, predominantly young women, are facing verbal abuse, sexual harassment, and racism from customers. Juliana Murphy says she's had grown men yell and raise a fist at her just because of contact tracing at the Halifax breakfast restaurant where she works. She says she knew asking them to show proof of their COVID-19 shots would be even worse. Restaurant staff say while most customers are respectful, others are argumentative and angry, making the added work of enforcing COVID-19 restrictions both exhausting and stressful. Don Kelly, The Canadian Press.
Let's look at the overall vaccination picture in Canada. The provinces and territories administered over 40,000 doses of vaccine yesterday, which means that 88.11% of eligible Canadians have had one shot, while 82.78% of eligible Canadians are fully vaccinated. Now looking abroad, America's top infectious disease expert continues to urge more people to get vaccinated. Janaid Norman has more.
With trick-or-treating and the holidays right around the corner, Dr. Fauci urging everyone who's eligible to get vaccinated.
If you're vaccinated and your family members are vaccinated, you can enjoy Halloween, trick-or-treating, and certainly Thanksgiving with your family and Christmas with your families.
But still, there are approximately 66 million unvaccinated Americans, and vaccine mandates continue to cause controversy.
The Seattle Police Department, which is already understaffed, could lose more officers once a vaccine requirement goes into effect today. And then looking even further abroad, the European Union says it has exported more than 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines to the rest of the world. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the vaccines have been sent to more than 150 nations, making the 27-member bloc the largest exporter of vaccines in the world.
We have always shared our vaccination production and capacity fairly with the rest of the world. We've said that at least every second dose is produced in the European Union will go abroad, and we have reached that with this important milestone.
Von der Leyen also says the EU will donate at least 500 million doses to middle and low-income countries that are affected most by the pandemic. And then looking into the Middle East, Israeli officials say they are winning the fight against COVID-19. Jordana Miller explains.
Israel's prime minister for the first time says his country is defeating the Delta variant. But Naftali Bennett cautioned it's not over until it's over. Israel will not pause its booster vaccine campaigns, stop testing, nor lift face mask and green pass mandates. Daily infections here now dipping below 1,000. That's a three-month low. Serious cases also falling by 65%. Jordana Miller, ABC News, Jerusalem.
Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. On Friday, we asked you, as temperatures drop across the country, does that make you less likely to do outdoor dining at a bar or a restaurant? 62% of you said yes. 38% of you said no. Our daily poll for today, coming from the world of Dave Brown was watching a lot of TV this weekend. Should political parties be allowed to run attack ads outside of election campaigns? Yes or no? So, I was watching a little football this weekend. Surprise, surprise. And by a little, I mean that's mostly what I did for the vast majority of it. And a couple of different times, I saw ads, attack ads, being run against NDP leader in Ontario, Andrea Horvath, by the Ontario PC party. Now, it should be noted that the election advertising rules have changed in Ontario over the course of the last couple of years. The Conservative Party did pass legislation that allows political ads to run within 12 months of an election. But it was a little bit jarring because we know the election is still a good 6 months away here in Ontario. So it was a little jarring to see attack ads rolling already. But I suppose it's fair game. It just seemed a little off-putting. Let's bring in Mike Ross. Mike Ross, what do you think? Should political parties be allowed to run attack ads outside of an election campaign?
Should they be allowed? Well, they are allowed, right? That is the law. So,
yeah, as I mentioned, However, they are allowed. They are allowed to do so legally. They changed the law to make sure they could do that.
So they should be allowed. However, do I disagree with that law? 100%. And the reason is simple. I mean, and in fairness, I saw the same ads you're talking about. I saw ads that the PC party put out against the Liberals and Michael Del Duca. I also saw ads against the Doug Ford government out there as well. So everybody's doing it now. I shouldn't say everybody. I didn't see anything from the NDP. I saw it from the Conservatives. I saw it from the Liberals. However, I really do appreciate the fact, Dave, that in Canada, for the most part, our elections are short-lived cycles. I do not want to spend the next 6 months watching these things and seeing them ad nauseum and feeling like we're again, Americanizing our system. Enough of this. We don't need this. We don't need the constant reminders of the political, you know, the landscape in which we live. People are aware of it. And honestly, if you'd come to me 2 weeks ago and said, okay, Rossi, I want you to write the taglines or write the criticism lines for attack ads, one by the Conservatives, one by the NDP, one by the Liberals, I would have written exactly what's out there. Everybody knows. Everybody knows they're going to attack Doug Ford on long-term care, on COVID, on his mismanagement of COVID-19. Everybody knows they're going to go after Del Duca and say, you don't know this guy because he's been in the shadows. Oh, but don't forget, he was part of the Kathleen Wynne government. Ooh, Kathleen Wynne, that terrible, terrible Kathleen Wynne. And they're going to play the card that always gets played against the NDP. oh, these guys could never form government. Remember Bob Rae, you know, 350 years ago, Bob Rae, when he was premier, and what happened? Come on.
Yeah.
No. So I'm with you. I don't like the fact that we're going to get bombarded with these for the next 6 months. And though it is quote unquote allowed because it's the law, I don't think it should have been made the law.
Yeah, I 100%. I think you're onto it. That American cycle of just years and years of campaign ads over and over from primaries to elections. And I think the reason why I chose the word attack ads in this question, I wouldn't find it so distasteful if these parties were making cases for themselves, talking about what they want to do, because I think that's a bit of a different messaging. But the attack ads just feel so gross 6 months out.
Yes, they do. Absolutely, they do. And the thing is, we don't know who, for example, Michael Del Duca is. And I've said I can remember a specific conversation I had with somebody over a year ago saying, this guy's got to get out there and get known because nobody knows who he is. If you went to, I would say, a very large majority of Ontarians and said, who's the leader of the Liberal Party in Ontario? People are going to go, Kathleen Wynne or Dalton McGuinty.
Yeah.
I guarantee you. And so this guy needed to really market himself a long time ago. And I think it might be a little bit too late for that now. Mm. However, you're absolutely right, Dave. Those ads do nothing to promote what the party stands for. All it is tearing down what what they see as the demonizing of the other parties. Mm-hmm. And to me, I mean, I'm a longtime, you know, political nut. And I look back at when I first started getting involved in election campaigns and supporting candidates and stumping for candidates. It's a different game now. And you're right. I don't like the way those ads make me feel.
Mm-hmm. Mike, getting a little passionate about Ontario politics first thing on a Monday. Yeah. We like this. I like that. Let's bring in Nisreen Abdelmajid. Nisreen, what do you think? Should political parties be allowed to run attack ads outside of an election campaign?
Well, Rossi nailed that answer. He's absolutely right. I feel like it's distasteful. It's not good. I can't speak on a Monday morning.
Oh, Nisreen, I think you heard me stumble over my news a couple times today. We're all shaking the cobwebs out.
This is we're trying our best on a Monday morning, but I think it's gross and it's very predictable. Like, you know what they're gonna talk about the other person. You know how they're gonna attack, and I like how you use that word attack because I feel like it's so negative, and that's another reason why I absolutely hate it. And I know that's how it is. I know this is how they're going to attack. This is how attack ads work. It's just very predictable. And many other Canadians, I absolutely hate it.
Yeah, I'm already going to feel very blah, and the election is still 6 months away. Daniel Penamondo, what do you think? Should political parties be allowed to run attack ads outside of campaigns?
So, I mean, I can barely stomach attack ads during an election campaign. It just reeks of, like, children let loose in the schoolyard, being like, you know, pointing fingers, you know, telling on the, you know, the teacher what the other kids are doing. And, like, I don't even have a stomach for that, let alone outside of the campaign. Like, I agree. I want to hone in on one point that Rossi mentioned is, like, you spend so much time attacking other parties that you don't even, like, prop up what you stand for. Mm-hmm. Like, put all your energy into what you, like, I wish every party did this. Just concentrate on what you stand for and let the people decide. Like, imagine how much better the debate stage be your arena, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. How much better would debates be if you saved all your ammo, your quote unquote ammo, on the other parties for the debate stage, and you can just kind of, like, let loose there and let that be your, again, arena. But that's just my take.
Regular members of the audience will tell you how sick they are of me saying this after every single election campaign. It seems year in, year out, the people who win these election campaigns are the people who paint the picture of the kind of society they want to live in. For good or bad, you may not agree with the picture they paint, but it seems like a lot of these parties who end up winning are the ones that actually go on the offensive, not by attacking their opponents, but by discussing the kind of society they want to live in. Now, that's not a 100% universally the case, but it seems more and more the parties that are willing to paint out that vision are the ones that have success in politics. Hey, Daniel, thank you for this. Appreciate hearing your insight. That was the whole crew that we just heard. I want to hear from you too. At AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. Send us emails, feedback@AMI.ca, or give us a phone call, 1-866-509-4545. Let's go back to Nazreen Abdel-Majid. She has the national weather update.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Starting off with St. John's, we're expecting periods of drizzle, then cloudy fog patches dissipating with a high of 8. In Halifax, a mix of sun and clouds, chance of showers with a high of 16. In Montreal, few showers, then mainly cloudy with a chance of showers and a high of 11. Moving to Ottawa, cloudy, chance of showers with a high of 10. In Toronto, cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 1. Thunder Bay, sunny fog patches dissipating with a high of 18. In Winnipeg, sunshine with a high of 22.
Tropical Winnipeg. Everyone says Winnipeg in October. Tropical.
Beautiful day out. That's a beach day right there. In Saskatoon, mainly sunny with a high of 13. Calgary, cloudiness increasing with a high of 7. In Edmonton, cloudy becoming a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 6. Moving to Yellowknife, mainly cloudy, chance of flurries. The temperature steady near -1 and a wind chill of -3. In Vancouver, cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and clouds. Fog patches dissipating with a high of 11. And in Victoria, mainly sunny, fog patches dissipating with a high of 11 as well. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Coming up next, we'll be joined by Michelle McQuigg of the Canadian Press for the Weekend News Recap. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. The U.S. State Department and the FBI are working to free 17 missionaries kidnapped in Haiti over the weekend. Michelle McQuigg is here with the Weekend News Recap. Michelle is the Weekend News Editor with the Canadian Press. Hey, good morning, Michelle. So, Michelle, I know the details here are still a little bit sparse, but what do we know about the 17 people kidnapped? Who are they? Oh, we're having a little, are we having a technical issue there with Michelle? I think I hear some sound in the background. Let's actually do a quick little pivot here. We'll give ourselves a second to reconnect with Michelle McQuigg. Daniel, I know you're in the middle of trying to connect with Michelle, but why don't we jump ahead to the Canadian Press Morning Business Minute with reporter Karen Rebo.
Canada's main stock index reached record highs in trading Friday, due in part to the strength of the energy sector as the price of oil climbed past $82 US per barrel. It's hovering around $83 a barrel this morning. Toronto's TSX index gained 108 points Friday to close at 20,928. New York's Dow Jones average surged 382 points and the Nasdaq added 73. In Tokyo this morning, the Nikkei index lost 43 points and our dollar is trading over this morning at 80.73 cents U.S. Facebook plans to hire 10,000 workers in the European Union over the next 5 years to work on a new computing platform. The company said in a blog post yesterday that those high-skilled workers will help build the metaverse, a futuristic notion for connecting people online that encompasses augmented and virtual reality. And coming up in business today, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation is set to release housing starts figures for September. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Karen Rebo.
All right, so we've endeavored to connect with Michelle and we seem to have succeeded. Hey, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave. I'm sorry about the internet gremlin over here.
We can always count on the internet being our friend on a Monday. So, Michelle, we've had these 17 missionaries who were kidnapped in Haiti over the weekend. What do we know about these 17 people? Who are they?
It's a good question, and we don't know a whole lot at this stage, but we did hear from a group called Christian Aid Ministries. They're the ones who released a statement, and everything we know is coming from them at this stage. All they've disclosed is that the 17 people consisted of one Canadian citizen and 16 American citizens, that we have 7 women, 5 men, and 5 kids in the group. We know that they were taken on Saturday in a place called Gantier, which is a bit east of Port-au-Prince, which is the Haitian capital, and that the group was visiting an orphanage at the time. This is all according to Christian Aid Ministries. That is about it in terms of what we know. We don't know ages or names or anything. Any kind of ransom demand has been made, but In terms of the group, it's now quite clearly established. We knew at the start that it was a missionary group, but now we have some more clear-cut confirmation on that front.
So, Michelle, what about the organization or the people that did the kidnapping? Who are they? What do we know about them?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So there's been a real spike in gang violence in Haiti overall, and I'll come back to that. But this is a group called the 400 Mowozo Gang. Forgive me if my pronunciation is wrong. Apparently, it loosely translates to 400 inexperienced men. And this is a gang that's a fairly major one, and they control a fairly sizable region, apparently, east of Port-au-Prince, that includes Gantier. And they're the ones who are being blamed for this particular kidnapping. So they're one of many gangs, like I said, that have been in the mix in recent months, especially this year. Things tapered off a little bit after the Haitian president was assassinated earlier this year. And the earthquake, of course, a couple months ago also paused things a little bit. But there's been a report from the UN that's tracked a huge spike in gang activity from 400 Mowozo and others. They're saying that so far there have been about 328 kidnappings in the first 8 months of this year that are considered to be gang-related. That's compared to 234 for all of last year.
Michelle, I know that you said there's not necessarily official demands yet in terms of hostage demands, but who is responsible for the hostage negotiations at this point?
That's a very good question, actually. And we haven't heard a whole lot about this in terms of where it's going. The government, the Canadian government is being very quiet about all of this. They haven't even actually confirmed that there's a Canadian missing. So if there's government involvement from Canada's end, we're not privy to it yet because we're still waiting for a whole lot more confirmation of even more basic facts there. But obviously in Haiti itself, if they're dealing with these kinds of kidnappings quite regularly, which they are, and they've even had some quite high profile ones this year alone, they obviously have some mechanisms in place to try and start dealing with this.
Right. So has there been any response from the Haitian government, for example?
Not so far, to my knowledge.
Okay.
Now, worth noting that I was actually not on this weekend, but that could well have changed, too, in the early hours of today. So it's possible that I've missed something.
Which then allows us to shift gears to this, Michelle, because you have been on vacation for a couple of weeks now, not manning the weekend news desk at the Canadian Press.
No.
How was it? What did you do?
It was lovely. Nice to be able to switch off the news a little bit. That's always one of the bigger upsides of a break. But yeah, it was really nice, very low key. But spent a lot. The big focus was to see people. Since social life has resumed and on weekends, I'm kind of out of the mix. This was a good chance to see a bunch of friends, go spend the long weekend with family, something I don't normally get to do anymore. That kind of stuff. It was very nice indeed.
That does sound lovely. I'm actually going to be speaking to a couple of young journalism students today from the Voices for Connect, the Voices for Ability program, which I'm really excited
for.
Cool. And one of the questions they're asking
is
how do you stay on top of all these current affairs and all this news? And I'm like, relentlessly, just relentlessly,
yeah.
Just constantly.
Yeah, you just... Yeah, just be at a state of high alert constantly and everything will be fine.
So, Michelle, you were eavesdropping a little bit on
detoxes
us.
Are crucial, I have to tell you.
Michelle, you
don't listen to Dave, students.
especially don't listen to Dave about anything he says, especially when he tells you, like, find a different career path, you'll be much happier. That's not true. That's not true. I love my job. Michelle, you were eavesdropping on us a little bit during the course of the last segment. You logged into the your Opal account a little bit. No, it's good. And I heard that you were a little bit curious what we were talking about. Well, it's our daily poll question of the day, which folks can find at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media on Facebook. And the question is whether or not should political parties be allowed to run attack ads outside of election campaigns? Now, we did establish, and we talked about this on the news panel a few months ago, that the Ontario government did change election advertising rules that allows any party to run ads within a year of the election. But I saw a bunch of attack ads popping up on TV over the weekend, and it struck me 6 months out from an election, a little bit distasteful to see some attack ads.
Yeah, I didn't have the pleasure of seeing that, but that is quite the thorny question. So you want to hear my hot take on that one?
Hit us.
My poll answer?
Yeah, hit us.
I'm a no. If I'm voting in this poll, I'm a no. I have big time concerns about the political climate and political environment at the best of times. And having open season on attack ads, which, as we all know, can also be very prominent platforms for misinformation or things taken out of context. It's not the tool I would choose to foster more transparent and civil discourse. How about that?
I like that. That's a good answer. Michelle, thank you for this. We'll talk to you again for the news panel on Friday.
Sounds good. Have a great week.
That's Michelle McQuigg, the weekend news editor with the Canadian Press. Coming up next, digital accessibility specialist Denis Boudreau will continue our conversation on design and inclusion. We're going to address whether or not websites and digital spaces that are designed inaccessibly present a bigger danger in terms of catching viruses or malware or spyware for people with disabilities. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's continue our conversation on design and inclusion. There are plenty of elements out on the web that can compromise your device: viruses, malware, spyware, keyloggers, and probably a bunch of other stuff we're not even aware of. Sometimes a single click or a tap can take you down a dangerous digital pathway. Which leads me to this question. Do websites designed without inclusive practices present an increased risk for a person with a disability? For his thoughts on this, we're joined by digital accessibility specialist Denis Boudreau. Denis is also the founder of Inclusive Communication. Hey, good morning, Denis. Great to chat with you once again.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Denis, just before we jump into this topic, our paths have crossed outside of the Now with Dave Brown universe. I was recently interviewed on the A11Y Rules podcast with Nicholas Steinhout, a podcast that you've also appeared on. Nick does extensive work in digital inclusion. You wanted to take a moment just to talk about Nick and his work. What did you find yourself chatting about on his show?
Oh, well, Nick and I go way back. Long story short, we've met about, I want to say, 7 or 8 years ago, and he was this guy from New Zealand, and then I realized after a couple of months talking to him in English that he was actually a guy from Shawinigan, Quebec, that had moved over there, and he was actually speaking French also. So we discovered these things about one another, way after we've met. But he's always been someone who was very much involved in accessibility and in this space. And he started that podcast, I want to say, a little over 2 years ago now. And I might have been his second or third guest on that podcast. And back then, it was really about, having conversations with people who work in the accessibility space, discover how they feel about it, like what their experience is like, their perspectives on different things. And then it kept evolving over the years in terms of the podcast itself. For those of your listeners who are interested in the podcast, interesting to hear about these questions. The podcast is called A11Y Rules. So A11Y Rules. He does two things. He does these longer interviews, and he also does these smaller pieces, sound bites, which are really introducing or interviewing a person with a disability to get their perspective on a particular thing. So I appeared on that too, as a colorblind individual. So talking about my experience, using the web with a color deficiency perception, mm-hmm. and you know what that means in terms of my everyday life working with the web or working with computers or things like that.
Yeah, he brought me on to talk about the perspective as someone who's legally blind but who doesn't use a screen reader, and people mm-hmm. apparently were really interested to hear about how someone who identifies as legally blind doesn't necessarily think about the screen reader as their number one way of navigating the web. So yeah, we love the work that Nick does. So big shout out to Nick. I know he listens to the show on the regular. So right. Nick, keep up the great work, man. Always appreciate hearing from you. Hey, Denis, let's jump back into this topic of digital safety. In that intro, I posed a question as to whether or not inclusive websites can pose a greater risk for a person with a disability in terms of acquiring a malware, a virus, etc. And it does come from a bit of personal experience when I visit particularly cluttered websites with pop-ups that are opening new browsers, windows, tabs, or taking me to unwanted websites. And those pop-ups are oftentimes very hard to get off the screen. So, Denis, what do you think about my question there, my thesis about whether or not these poorly designed websites can create a danger for a person with a disability?
It pains me to say that I think you're completely right. There are so many different ways in which someone who doesn't have a full perspective of what the site offers be led into a particular pitfall in that sense. You can only imagine, you're not using a screen reader, so you probably don't get to see that as much as others would if they're using one. But all these different buttons, for instance, or links or call to actions that are not labeled. So you hear about a link, for instance, but you don't really know what the link is for. Every time that someone tries such a link, you know, just to see what's going to happen, they expose themselves to potentially being lured into, you know, any kind of issue like that. Images that are not labeled, for instance, you know, content that pops up on your screen and you don't know where that content is, and you have to explore that, but you don't really see what's going on, or you're not really hearing anything about what the concept is or the context is. All these things could easily lead into you being lured into some kind of a trap, or some kind of a, you know, downloading something that you didn't expect, or going to a website that you didn't expect. So yeah, there definitely is a risk. And it's an interesting question because, you know, we're so caught up in MySpace, we're so caught up in, you know, just making content accessible, working with organizations who are well-intentioned. But your question brings up the fact that some people could potentially take advantage of the fact that some people have disabilities and therefore they are a certain disadvantage when it comes to navigating on the web, to actually take advantage of that. Mm. And that's a really interesting question that I want to spend time looking at, for sure.
I like it when I can ask a question that gets you experts thinking about stuff, when I can pull you guys out of your true expertise and drag you into my world of paranoia, yeah, and Ludditeness. Dini, so let's talk about some mitigations or proactivities that people can do here. If my thesis is indeed somewhat correct, what are some good habits that people can develop to keep their machines digitally clean? Is it something as simple as antivirus software, just keeping a good antivirus software on their machine?
Well, I think that's a given, right? I mean, in today's day and age, even if you're, like, you know, I work on a Mac computer 99% of the time, and I feel rather secure compared to a Windows environment, for instance. But even then, I've learned not to trust just relying on Mac as an environment where typically you don't get viruses. It's not as true as it used to be. So I think that in terms of, you know, digital hygiene or you know, good habits or practice to have, I don't think that having a disability makes it any different than someone who doesn't. I mean, everyone should be very careful about not, you know, not clicking on any random link that seems a little weird or, you know, unexpected or anything like that. But maybe even more so if you are in a context where you're relying on a screen reader, for instance, because it's very easy it's very easy for me to put down a link that leads to a certain area, but then have some code that makes you think that it's going elsewhere. I mean, when you're, you know, when you're sighted, for instance, you could always mouse over that link and see the URL, see the actual, you know, destination of that link. It might help for some people, but if you can't do that because you can't operate a mouse, for instance, or you can't see any visual cues on the screen, you entirely rely on what the code actually says. And if the code was intentionally created to mislead you, you're likely to be misled. So I think there's a need to be more cautious, I guess, if you are non-sighted, for instance, and you rely on a screen reader. But everyone really should be very careful. And, you know, some of these things, like looking into, well, yeah, I mean, let's stick to that for now. But you know, antivirus software or anything that protects in that sense is certainly a good idea. And you know, obviously maintaining that, you know, at least weekly, I'd say, making sure that it's updated.
What about some other strategies? Like, I know some browsers offer things like ad blockers. I know I've heard from some folks saying, well, the key is to clear out your cache. And, you know, like, and I always wondered, like, are these effective strategies? Are these part of the ways in which we can mitigate some of the risks?
Certainly. I mean, I don't tend to use ad blockers myself because I do a lot of assessment and auditing on websites, and I guess I'm a little lazy. I could disable them when I have to work on assessing things, but I've just accepted that they're the bane of our existence. I mean, they remind you of what your browsing history is and all that good stuff. But definitely, you know, if this is not something that you have to do and you just want a bit more privacy, that's certainly a good place to start with ad blockers. Another good place to start might be to turn on any of the incognito modes in your browsers so that you're not being tracked as much or at all by you know, different organizations, organizations or whatnot. Another option might also be to clearing your cache, as you said. I mean, doing that regularly is certainly a good idea. You don't want to go too far there, because if you have to re-enter your passwords all the time, it might be a problem. But, you know, another good practice might be to use any kind of password. I forget the exact name, but, you know, password software that tracks all of your passwords, like 1Password, for instance, or LastPass, that sort of thing. Not really pushing for any of those software in particular, but, you know, software that are intended to help you remember those passwords would make it easier. Now, again, from the perspective of someone with a disability, if those tools aren't particularly accessible, that doesn't help that much either. Yeah. So there's always that consideration of, yeah, there are tools out there, but are those tools really that usable? And oftentimes the answer, sadly, is not really, or not as much as we'd like to.
Right. It becomes this perpetuating cycle. Some of the tools you might use to protect yourself end up being inaccessible in and of themselves, which ends up sort of feeding into the trouble as well. Denis, we're a little tight for time here, but any other sort of overarching advice you want to offer just before we wrap up the segment?
Another good hygiene idea would be, don't use the same password everywhere. I think it's something that we've heard many, many times over, but it's probably not a bad thing to repeat it again. If you're the kind of person who tends to have 1Password and use it everywhere, that's a super bad idea. So having different passwords and changing them regularly is also a good idea. If you're, maybe one last thing real quick, I just heard of that. I haven't had a chance to try it myself, but I've heard of that recently. In the latest version of iOS, for instance, Apple has introduced this feature where you can sort of fake email addresses. And then, so when you register to a service, you can let your iOS device sort of generate an email address for you. It redirects, so you can track who's using that address. So if you have specific addresses that you're creating for every one of the services that you register to, you can then monitor which one of those addresses actually picks up a lot of activity. And that could tell you a bit about whether or not that organization, that service, actually sells your information to other people, and then you get flooded with that email address. And then you can make a decision about whether or not you want to keep that service or other things. But yeah, it's giving us a little bit of power back in terms of controlling who gets to spam us with stuff.
I like that. Tracking the trackers. Now we're getting somewhere. It's like counter surveillance. I like that idea. Yep. Hey, Denis, always fun catching up. Thanks for doing something a little bit different with us today. I always appreciate it.
Absolutely. You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. That's Denis Boudreau, Digital Accessibility Specialist. Denis is also the founder of Inclusive Communication. Let's go catch up with Mike Ross for the big business story of the day. Mike, our daily poll question was a little bit Ontario-centric, and so is the big business story of the day. I think we have to explain to some folks about the Toronto Underground.
Well, it is and it isn't, because this is something that, you know, exists in Montreal. It exists in Ottawa, down on the Place de Ville and Spark Street in Ottawa, in Vancouver as well. It's the idea of underground malls, or in Toronto it's called the PATH system, but it's these underground systems where usually they're centered in the business sectors, the financial sectors, if you will, of downtowns. And it allows people who work in office towers that are sort of centralized in a very
densely populated area. Yep, I got you, big guy.
Downtown. And it's a series of different things. So, for example, restaurants, bookstores, sometimes clothing stores. I walk through the one in Toronto every time I go to a Toronto Maple Leafs game, because our parking garage is right under the TD Center in downtown Toronto. And it's been shuttered for the most part because of the pandemic. Well, what's happening now in Toronto, and I would presume in other cities across the country, is a lot of the offices that hire the people who would normally shop in these malls are now adopting permanent work from home policies and allowing almost a complete restructuring of their offices. In some cases, companies are actually downsizing their actual physical footprint in these buildings, and it's having a huge impact on the businesses that are set up under these office towers. And in Toronto specifically, which is a story out of the Globe and Mail this morning, they're talking about the fact that these businesses are now reopened, but the foot traffic is quite limited. I've noticed that even myself in using the one in Toronto, it's closed after a certain hour, whereas it used to be open and accessible 24 hours a day. You could walk through it. And so it's kind of interesting to see how these this whole business model of a mall and stores being underground, being built under these office towers that housed thousands and thousands of workers, are now just basically disappearing because the workplaces that these people used to populate are disappearing as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see the way those underground malls connect cities. And it's something that I had not thought about for a single second until you sent me that email this morning. And now it's all I'm thinking about. So, Mike, thank you for bringing this one to us today.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. Coming up after the break, film reviewer Kim Thistle will stop by and share her thoughts on the Netflix documentary Britney versus Spears. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's a Monday edition of AMI at the Movies, and we're happy to be joined by film reviewer Kim Thistle, who's going to share her thoughts on the documentary Britney versus Spears, which you can currently find on Netflix. And of course, Kim joins us from St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. Hey, Kim, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning. I don't know if you can see my Halloween pumpkin in the back. I wanted to dress up today, but Some people say that it's a bit early.
No. We're inside the two-week zone. It's officially time to get into the spooky season. No doubt about that. Hey, Kim, we know that Britney Spears has been in the news quite a bit over the course of the last year. I mean, over the last 20 years, if we're being really honest. But what aspect of Britney Spears' life do we get to learn about in this film?
Well, okay. So that's interesting. So I want to say right off the top, like, Britney Spears is not interviewed in this film, but it's about her conservatorship. Let's see if I said that right.
But You got it.
I have to break that down. Between her and her father. So she's contesting it. And just to give a brief overview, a conservatorship is done when it's felt that someone is not able to look after themselves, like for their food, their health, their shelter, their clothing. So because I surmise that because she has had mental health issues and her father and her family, and they felt that she was not able to take care of herself, and it was a danger and it being manipulated by others. However, I think the manipulation actually went the other way. So the conservatorship is like on her person and her estate. So, I mean, every decision was made for her. I mean, this is a grown woman. She was 26 years old when this conservatorship was put in place. She didn't even have a chance to, you had 5 days to contest it. That wasn't even permitted to her. So it brings up some questions of, you know, why did this happen and how did it happen?
You mentioned that Britney herself was not interviewed in this documentary, but who are the people behind it?
Well, behind it, well, we had, it was done by a director, Aaron Lee Kerr, and journalist, who's an executive producer, Jenny Elizu. Now, Elizu, she had wrote an article about Britney, I want to say, years before this movie they decided to do. And Rolling Stone, but they were originally focusing on media presence of Britney Spears and her artistry and, you know, what an icon she is. But then when they started exploring and getting their facts together or getting their information, they realized there's something about this conservatorship that's, you know, wasn't exactly above board, or why did this happen the way that it did?
So I'm curious, as they had maybe a little bit of that pivot in what they wanted to do and accomplish with the documentary, how do you think that impacted the presentation? Was there a bit of a mishmash, or did they manage to put together a pretty understandable narrative?
Well, I guess because for me, I'm watching it and I'm writing my notes and I'm trying to keep track and everything. So it part of me felt like they started off with a bang. You know, you get all these voices overlaying saying, you know, she was a good worker and she lost control of her life and all this. But then it, you know, starts off with a bang. But I felt like, geez, okay, I'm trying to follow this and that. Now, they did, you know, have pictures there and they put the dates and they tell you. But, you know, it was a lot to it. We're being, you know, she's not interviewed. And those who are interviewed are former assistant, a geriatric psychiatrist who may and may not have diagnosed Britney Spears. I mean, not very, he doesn't disclose that. There's former lawyers, former manager, former boyfriends. So these are the people that are being interviewed. And then they take from court documents and you know, maybe a words that, you know, a recording that Britney had left to her lawyer, that type of thing. So it's not direct from the horse's mouth, per se, or her father's.
So along those lines, Kim, we know how passionate the hashtag Free Britney movement was and how broad that conversation became. Would you say the documentary had some balance to it?
In a sense, like I, when I'm watching it, I was thinking, oh my gosh, okay, this is, you know, at first I wasn't really interested, and tell you the truth, because I mean, I got not following celebrity lifestyles. I mean, I got my own life, I got my own stuff to look after, right? So, but when I'm in this, and now that I reflect and look back, I said, oh my God, like they took every right away from this young girl who, you know, to say that she was diagnosed, like, listen to this, like dementia. A geriatric psychiatrist says that she has dementia. I mean, she's 26 years old. Yes, she has mental health issues and she's being, where we're assuming, being treated. But to take everything, like she can't even have a credit card and can't drive her own car. She's being threatened if she doesn't behave or work and that her children would be taken away from her. And I really believe, that's just my personal thing, that her, she wanted, not total line, but she had contested the conservatorship, but she kept getting overthrown about that. But her father would threaten her that she wouldn't get to see her kid. Now, this is a woman who made two CD. She did Las Vegas residency. She was able to do the X Factor, did a world tour, wrote those CD, choreographed it and everything. And yet she's not able to have a credit card or decide who she's going to hang out with.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah, ultimately, that's what it boils down to here, right? The we can talk about the importance of a conservatorship for sometimes the self-interest and safety of someone. But if somebody is really having those kinds of struggles, should the people running the conservatorship be like, yep, time to go on a 2-year world tour because that's going to be great for your mental health?
Yeah, and they had control over all their money, too. I mean, yeah. And part of that was, you know, making decisions. And they could set up their own business. And I say they, that was her father, and there was a court-appointed lawyer. But it was, you know, odd things happening. And I did not realize about the Free Britney movement because, you know, I'm just getting into it now and doing extra research. And I actually read this morning, I typed in Britney Spears, and up pops this, 3 hours ago, she wrote on Instagram, and she had her Christmas tree up, and she said, you know, I'm getting used to this, being able to make my own decisions, and I'm a little bit scared. I hope I don't make any mistakes, and, you know, it was so wrong what had happened, and if I ever speak, you know, they had basically, in a sense, watch out type of thing. But, I mean, she genuinely, you know, wants to do the right thing, and you know, she puts up a Christmas tree now in October. She said, just because she can, and she's getting the keys to her car. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Free Britney movement, you're right. The very lot of supporters, and you see that in the video.
Well, you know, if 2 weeks is too early for pumpkins, I'd say 2 months is too early for Christmas trees. But again, you know what? Be you. Live your best life. Kim, how was the audio description in this one?
Started off like when, you know, they don't tell us it's Britney. It says a blonde woman, you know, at a large concert venue, thousands of people, and the lights are on, and a blonde woman is walking up the stairs, and she turns around and smiles and that type of thing. So there's not a whole lot to be described. I guess they do tell us when she's in concert, and the voiceover, it says, you know, who's speaking, and it describes the paparazzi. I mean, that is phenomenal when you watch that young woman, that woman can't even, when she could drive, can't even go down the road without swarmed by paparazzi. So that type of thing. But it's a lot more of a talking. Does that make sense? There's not a lot to be described.
Mm-hmm. Talking heads.
They did tell us what we needed to know.
Excellent. Hey, Kim, very quickly here, out of 10, how do you rate it?
I'm not going to go. I find that so hard to give numbers. And for me, to stay or go or watch or turn on your Netflix or, you know, I'm not, now that I dislike Britney Spears, but I never followed her. And I think anybody that truly is interested in her and you know, likes her music and all that would find this an interesting topic. For me, it's eye-opening in a sense that I did not realize the extent of the conservatorship. I've only seen headlines, didn't really understand it. Okay, that's her life and stuff. But it makes me angry now that after I got this story. So I think, you know, if you're interested in this type of thing, understanding how conservatorship works, there's several documentaries out now. There's on another streaming platform too. So I think that, you know, they disclose things that this one, it seemed to be, give us surprises like that she has dementia. I mean, my gosh, she's 26 years old. A geriatric psychiatrist says this. So, I mean, makes you wonder, like, I'm dealing with this with my mother who's 81. And, you know, she's not able to pay her bills, but a 26-year-old. So I think if you're interested in that type of thing and real life, check it out.
Kim, thank you for this review. We always appreciate hearing your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
That's Kim Thistle, our film reviewer in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. Today she reviewed Britney versus Spears, which you can find on Netflix. Let's wrap up the hour by sharing a couple of news stories. Weeks after apologizing to an Indigenous chief for not accepting her invitation to an event marking Canada's first day for National Truth and Reconciliation, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will be in Kamloops, BC today for a meeting. Karen Rebo looks ahead.
The Prime Minister will visit the Tecumloops Suwetmuc Nation, which announced in May it had used ground-penetrating radar technology to find what are believed to be 215 unmarked graves at the site of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School. Several Indigenous nations have since reported finding unmarked graves at other shuttered, abuse-ridden residential schools. Today's visit comes after Trudeau's apology this month to Tecumloops Chief Roseanne Casimir for having traveled with his family to Tofino, BC, and not appearing at any in-person events September 30th to honour survivors of the state-sponsored residential school system. Karen Rebo, The Canadian Press.
As always, we cover a ton of ground in the first hour of the show, and I want to remind you that anything you hear on the show or anything you don't hear on the show is always welcome for your commentary. So if we're onto something or we're off of something, we want to hear about it. Send us emails, feedback@ami.ca, feedback@ami.ca. Find us on social media, @AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, or give us a ring-a-ding-ding, 1-866-509-4545, 1-866-509-4545. Coming up after the break, we'll have the regional news update. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. It's Monday, October the 18th, 2021. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Mark Aflalo of Double Tap TV will tell you about today's Unleashed Apple event. And in the Western Regional Report, Jim Crisco will tell you all about an inclusive playground in High River, Alberta. Let's begin the hour by handing things over to Mike Ross for the regional news update.
Thank you, Dave. We'll begin in British Columbia, and the Hong Kong Department of Health has banned direct flights from Vancouver operated by Air Canada for 2 weeks in response to COVID-19 cases. A statement posted to the department's website says health officials detected nearly 60 imported cases in the first 2 weeks of this month, including one passenger on an October 13th Air Canada flight from Vancouver. It says another passenger had failed to comply with disease prevention and control requirements, prompting officials to implement the ban, which will remain in effect until October 26th. Air Canada notes that its Toronto to Hong Kong flights are not affected. In the Prairies, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney says today's referendum on the federal equalization program is about whether or not Alberta should push hard to get a fair deal. The question for voters who are also heading to the polls in municipal elections is whether the section of the Constitution that enshrines the principle of equalization payments should be removed. Political science Jared Wesley recently conducted a survey on referendum voting intentions for the University of Alberta and says it appears the yes side is in the lead. But he says a disturbingly high percentage of people don't understand what equalization is all about. Ontario is where we're heading next, and Ontarians vaccinated against COVID-19 can now download enhanced scannable certificates. The provincial government says the documents will allow for faster entry into settings that require proof of vaccination. Under Ontario's vaccination certificate program, only those who've been fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or have a medical exemption from a doctor can access certain things like theaters, gyms, nightclubs, and restaurant dining rooms. And finally, in the Atlantic region, Mounties in Newfoundland and Labrador have issued a warning about a new telephone scam. RCMP in Twillingate say they've received complaints about scammers calling from a local number, claiming to be an employee of a cable TV company. They tell the victim they're eligible for a special COVID-19 rebate if they provide their social insurance number, driver's license, name, and date of birth. Police say no such rebate exists, and they're cautioning the public to be wary of sharing personal information with unknown callers. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country. Dave?
Thank you very much, Mike. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the hour, but guess who's back in the mix? It's Jeff Ryman with a sports chat. Jeff, we missed you last week. It was a busy, busy week in sports. How did you enjoy it? How much sports did you take in on your week off?
Probably too much, Dave, is the correct answer. You mentioned it was a crazy week. We had baseball, football, hockey's back, and of course, basketball starts tomorrow, which mm-hmm. I'm kind of excited to talk about as well, Dave. But yeah, the answer to your question, probably too much, although I don't feel too about it because I did have the week off, so it wasn't bad.
It does look like you've grown a pretty good vacation beard going.
Yes, you know what, Dave? You know, that's part of being on vacation is growing these playoff or vacation beards. Maybe a part of it is just being lazy and having to watch the dog a little bit too much past, the hours that I'd like, but here we are. I got the old beard going after vacation.
Looks good, man. I say keep it unless we get voted down from management. Hey, Jeff, before we get into the big football game tonight on Monday Night Football, a pretty darn good one at 8:15 Eastern time on TSN. Looks like we had a great weekend in football. We had three different games go to overtime in the NFL yesterday. I'm curious, which game had your attention the most during the day? I've got to admit, after the 1 o'clock window, I was a little emotionally checked out, and then New England and Dallas dragged me back into it.
That's the one I'm going with, Dave, is New England and Dallas. I mean, I had a little bit of money wagering on this game, and so I was more heavily invested than maybe the average viewer. But Dave, going back and forth, some questionable coaching calls by either team, a missed field goal going to overtime, interceptions. This game had it all. And literally had it all in probably the last 3 minutes of play. It was an exciting game. It was fun to watch New England lose, actually, as a Buffalo Bills fan. But this game was probably the most exciting game that I watched yesterday, Dave.
Jeff, the Dallas Cowboys, I think we knew they were going to win the division, the NFC East. I think we had a pretty strong sense of that. Did you think they were going to be this good? They're 5-1 going into their bye week. Their only loss is to Tom Brady, the defending champions, in a one-score game. Jeff, are the Dallas Cowboys for real?
Yeah, you know what, Dave? I can believe it. I still remember last year. I had them going to the Super Bowl, and obviously Dak Prescott had that pretty gruesome injury that left him out for the remainder of the year. So, you know, the talent is definitely there for the Dallas Cowboys. Everybody talks about their offense, but their defense has actually been surprisingly good so far this year. And I mean, look at Trayvon Diggs, one of the guys, second-year player, 7 interceptions already on the year for Trayvon Diggs, which is 7 more interceptions than the New York Jets. The Jets still have 0 interceptions on the year, and one individual player of the NFL already has 7, including a pick 6 late in yesterday's game against the New England Patriots. So I think their defense has been a pleasant surprise for the Cowboys. I don't know if I would call them legit Super Bowl contenders, but you know what, Dave? They're starting to make a pretty good case for being a playoff team in potentially a Super Bowl contender.
Yeah, we knew the offense was going to be good, even though there were questions about Dak Prescott coming back from the dislocated slash broken ankle, even though the breakout concept of CeeDee Lamb, their second-year wide receiver, we didn't know. Micah Parsons, their first-round draft pick, playing at linebacker this year. You know, there were questions, and so far they've really risen to the task, and they've beaten a couple good teams along the way, including a team like the Los Angeles Chargers in the second week of the season. So I'm starting to get a little bit cowboyish over here. It's starting to be kind of exciting. All right, Jeff, speaking of Super Bowl contenders, you mentioned that you're a Buffalo Bills fan. They're on the road tonight in Nashville for a tilt with the Titans. Jeff, I don't think the Titans are good, and I'm pretty much convinced the Bills are good. Do you think there might be a blowout in play tonight?
There very well could be. And last week we saw the Bills defeat Kansas City, and I think that was a bit of a revenge game, and I think you're going to see a little bit of the same tonight. Revenge is probably, on the Buffalo Bills' minds, as they got destroyed last year in Tuesday Night Football. Remember that?
I do remember that.
You know, COVID wreaked havoc, and things had to be rescheduled, and it was the first Tuesday Night Football game since the 1940s or something, and the Bills just, they lost, and Tennessee had, you know, half of their team on the COVID-19 list, but yet still somehow beat the Buffalo Bills. So I think revenge is probably, you know, at the forefront of their minds for Buffalo.
They beat them by absolutely running the ball down their throat. Yeah. Buffalo could not stop the Tennessee running game that Tuesday Night Football game last year.
Yeah. I mean, Derrick Henry is a beast. The guy put up over 2,000 rushing yards last year. And we talked about him, I think, a lot last year. 6'3", 250 pounds, and is probably one of the fastest guys on the field, which is just ridiculous to think about. But this year, the Bills defense, you know, the offense seems to be getting a lot of love. I mean, Josh Allen is in that MVP discussion. Stephon Diggs had a huge year last year and is slowly starting to pick it up towards, this year. The middle of this year, but their defense has been outstanding. Each game, I feel like there's always that one player that really picks up, and they're able to do it in a multitude of ways, whether it's stuffing teams on fourth down. I feel like that's something the Bills have done a lot this year, picking off quarterbacks. I think their edge rushing has gotten a lot better, especially with drafting Greg Rousseau out of Miami this year. Their defense is on a different level this year. I think they're the only team that has not allowed more than 70 points total throughout the entire season. They've shut out teams twice so far this
year.
Yeah,
but who would they shut out? They shut out the Dolphins and the Texans. Like, congratulations.
I'll still take it, Dave. It's pretty impressive to not even allow a field goal against, you know, NFL teams. So, you know, having
it's that not said, clear whether the Dolphins or the Texans are NFL teams. Maybe on paper only.
Yeah, paper only. I'll give you that one, Dave. But still, their defense looks really, really good. I know they've prided themselves on defense before, but this year I think it's even more legit. They're getting contributions from everywhere. If they can contain Derrick Henry, which I really strongly think they can, which is going to be a hard task, but you have to also look Tennessee. I think they're still dealing with some COVID-19 implications here. They have 12 or 14 guys out injured this game, including AJ Brown, who's questionable, one of their top wide receivers. Julio Jones is questionable, although I think he's probably going to play, but he has hamstring issues. And in the past, Julio Jones with the hamstring definitely doesn't look like the Julio Jones you're used to seeing. And your guy Ryan Tannehill here, Dave, probably an average quarterback at best. So I think the Bills are probably going to be licking their chops to see if they can get some revenge tonight.
8:15 Eastern time on TSN is when that game goes. And Jeff, let's just take a quick look to see what the sports fans in Las Vegas have to say about this game. They think the Bills are a 6-point favorite, and I think it might be even worse than that for the Tennessee Titans tonight. Jeff, thank you for this.
Enjoy the game, Dave.
That is Jeff Ryman. He is at the AMI Sports Desk. Let's head over to the AMI Weather Desk in Nazreen Abdelmajid.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada, starting off with Corner Brook. Cloudy, 60% chance of showers up to 15 millimeters, with the wind heading southeast, 40 kilometers an hour, gusting to 60, except gusting to 100 along parts of the coast. with a high of 11. In Charlottetown, mainly cloudy with a chance of showers with the temperature steady near 13. St. John, mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers with a high of 14. Quebec City, mainly cloudy, chance of showers with a high of 11. Toronto, cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 1. Sault Ste. Marie, sunny, high of 16. Brandon, sunny, high of 21. In Regina, mainly sunny with a high of 17. Lethbridge, mainly sunny with a high of 10. In Red Deer, cloudiness increasing with a high of 6. Moving to Whitehorse, mainly cloudy, high of 1 and a wind chill of minus 13. Kelowna, clearing with a high of 15. And in Vancouver, we're expecting to be cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and clouds. Fog patches dissipating with a high of 11. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Coming up next, Mark Aflalo of Double Tap TV will offer some thoughts on today's Unleashed Apple event. But first, that's not the only big tech event happening this week. Here's Dave Packer with Tech Trends.
That's plenty to keep us busy.
Andrew Martinick is the editor-in-chief of Digital Trends. He says between Apple's MacBook Pro event on Monday, a new Google Pixel launch on Tuesday, and a Samsung Unpacked event on Wednesday, this Techtober is even busier than usual.
In the last few years, it's been like this, but this has been particularly serious.
He says there's a couple of reasons these hardware announcements have piled up.
With a lot of the chip delays, obviously not having big in-person events for the pandemic, and not having trade shows to see people at or launch things at. That's all just compressed things into the end of the year.
But while the Apple and Google events are major product launches, Samsung's may be a little more relaxed.
I expect this to be more of like a get ready for the holiday season. We'll roll out some new accessories, some special editions, special color ranges, things like that.
With Tech Trends, I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's talk tech with Mark Aflalo of Double Tap TV. Of course, you can find that program Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on AMI TV. Hey, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm well. So in a few hours, Apple is going to be having their Unleashed event. Mark, what are the expectations headed into this event?
Oh, a couple nice coffee mugs and no one there. We are expecting the finally rumored next generation M processor from Apple, which is supposed to power their new MacBook Pros, the new MacBook Airs, and maybe even some of their high-end iPads. But this is the big one. This is the big one that everybody's been talking about since last year's unveil of their own silicone, their own processor, which completely exceeded any expectation out there. And we're expecting to see the predecessor, the following up, you know, what is going to follow these processors? What are we going to see, especially on the Pro lineup of computers? Because we have not seen these chips really pushed to their limit and really developed for that Pro lineup of people who are, you know, rendering animations and producing high-end videos. People want to know what they can expect, what the commitment's going to be from Apple, and today is the day we hope to find that out.
What would you say the anticipation level is in regards to that from some of, like, the hardcore Apple users?
Oh, the hardcore Apple users have been wondering why it's taken so long, even though they know it's a yearly cycle and it takes its time. But people on the edge of their seats, they're wondering, okay, you've released these processors last year. People have been pushing them to their limits, and they've far exceeded any expectations. Even Apple themselves have admitted that these chips have exceeded any expectations, to the point that people over at Intel and AMD are saying, well, I hope Apple comes back one day and gives us some of their business. But the fact of the matter is that Apple broke the code. They figured out how to do these processors, how to do them properly, and they've graduated from just powering mobile devices to powering full-fledged computers and doing all the stuff we've become, you know, accustomed to with a computer. And not only that, but they've also picked up the adoption from all the software manufacturers out there as well. The Microsofts of the world, the Adobes of the world, those are always the ones that are hard to follow, you know, because when you come up with a new processor, that's great. When it's not right out of the box compatible with all the existing software that's out there, you have to count on those partners to say, okay, we're gonna commit resources and time and energy to make sure our software works on it. And they did, and they proved that not only does it work, but it works even better than Intel, even better than AMD, and obviously incredibly well so on Mac hardware.
So before the break, we played a tech trends report that suggested it's going to be a busy week in the world of technology with a Google Pixel reveal, a Samsung event. Is an October event abnormal for Apple?
And you know what? This is something new to the past, I would say, 2 years or so. Typically, that September event where we saw the unveiling of the Apple Watch and the iPhone, that would have been the last one before the holiday season, giving them some time to ramp up production. Now, because there are so many new products and so many new chips and things that are being developed, they really have to split it up because they're splitting up the attention span. You know, the iPhone and the iPads really hit a consumer level of audience. You know, they need to make sure that it gets into the carrier hands. And that takes a lot of time. You know, I remember talking to a friend of mine over at Rogers that said, okay, well, Apple just unveiled the new operating system and new phones. We just found out this morning, like everybody else did, and then they scrambled to make sure that everything is ready for it a week later, you know? Whereas when it comes to the computers, there's no one really out there scrambling for anything other than Apple themselves. So when they come to the table in October, this is most likely going to be the last event of the year leading up to the holiday season. So we're expecting to see those new Macs. We're expecting to maybe see a new version of the AirPods because that has not been released yet. And there is speculation that we would see these before the holiday season. However, it's also not unlike Apple to release a couple small products via a press release in a week or two from now. And they sometimes do that so they don't share the spotlight with too many things. They don't want us to consume too much, Dave. Our brains are small.
Well, they know they can also get their headlines when they release the AirPod press release in 2 weeks, right? They know that whatever they do, they're going to get a release. They're going to get a headlines. People are going to talk about it. So why release a million things at once when you can give people a trickle instead of a flow? Mark, you mentioned a couple of different products there, and to say that the Apple universe is vast would actually be something of an understatement. Would you say computers and Macs are still the main focus of Apple?
Probably not, Dave, to be perfectly honest, because if you look at the revenue, okay, and you look at across the board of this company, whether it be iPhones, the music side of things, the software, the Apple TV, iPhones are still number one in terms of the revenue-making machine for Apple. They, you know, the iPod transitioned out into the iPhone, and that is absolutely the big money maker. Second to that, it's not hardware, it's software. It's all the iCloud, all the Apple Music, all the Apple Fitness, and everything else that comes along for the ride. So I think when you look at this company, you almost have to look at it in different silos and different almost companies within a company, which is why, you know, the government and a lot of people speculate that these companies should be broken up, because you look at it, you know, they have got their iPhone and their mobile business, they've got their software business, and then they've got this computer business. And they all really are separate different companies within this giant umbrella that is Apple. That being said, no other companies out there work so harmoniously together like this. You know, when you look at how well integrated the iPhone is to, you know, the music and the services and then into the hardware and the software lineup of things, it really is quite a symbiotic relationship. You can't say the same for the PC world. They're trying hard. Windows is trying hard on the, with Android apps and making sure things are cross-compatible and you can use your Android phone on a Windows machine and even use, you know, iCloud services on a Windows machine. But unless you're under the same roof, unless you're sharing the same secrets and the design and the teams, it's going to be impossible for you to ever meet those kind of expectations. So this is an interesting beast, but mobile is definitely still high atop that list of what keeps that company afloat.
Yeah, I think that speaks to just the place where computers fit into our lives now. Yes, we still use computers on the regular. Certainly for work, the computer is something I use a lot. But I would say the majority of the day-to-day operations of my world in the digital space is on my phone. So it stands to reason that the focus would be there. And certainly I am not the center of the universe, despite the fact that I live in the greater Toronto area, which implies that that is indeed the center of the universe. But it does speak to the way in which people are using their phones way more in the digital space than probably any other device.
And think about this for a second. Think about the fact that the processor in that phone, okay, whatever that phone might be, let's focus on Apple for a second. Here, the processor in those Apple phones are equal, if not greater, than the processors in the Macs that were released a year ago. So that phone is so underused for the power that is at its disposal that we've just scraped the surface of what that phone can do. To think that we might live in a world where that phone might be the central computing device, you go home, you just plug it into a TV, even if you have to plug it in, or you just pop up your keyboard and your mouse and you get a much larger experience off the same piece of hardware, is not something that is, this is totally expected.
Yeah.
We're going to see this. You know, we're seeing companies, especially Samsung, are making inroads with their DeX product, where you just plug it in and suddenly you have this giant desktop experience.
Yeah.
So this is not, this is not down the road in 10 years from now. This is 2-3 years from now. And we're seeing this with the evolution of the iPad and the iPad taking on a new form in terms of the operating system. And we're seeing this, and we're going to see this on the Windows side of things with, for example, their Surface Duo, which is that dual screen device that has about 8 inches across the board. We want to compute with these one devices. We don't want multiple things. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of infrastructure. That's a lot of stuff for us to remember. So if we can do that all on that one device, I think we're going to win across the board. And that's at the end of the day, Dave, consumers are the ones that win no matter what happens here. We get the benefit of all the competition that goes on, all the arguing in the courts. We win at the end of the day, which is the fun part.
Mark, if people want to tune into this Apple Unleashed event today, is there a way for them to do so?
Yeah, on any Apple device or any other device, just go to apple.com. It starts at 1 p.m. Eastern. They're pretty polished keynotes. I wouldn't expect it to go longer than about 40 minutes. This one, I'm not 100% sure if it's pre-recorded or not. There is speculation that it might be live broadcast from Apple Campus, the first one in over 2 years now because of the pandemic. So could be interesting, but it might be packaged. I might be completely wrong there.
One of my favorite ones of those of all time was Steve Ballmer releasing, I think it was Windows 8 of Microsoft, and he's out there clapping, yeah. It was awesome. So, yeah, let's
go. It's so fun to look back the memory lane and watch some of those videos from yesteryear.
This is a mouse. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Mark, what's coming up on Double Tap TV tomorrow night?
Oh, very cool. Very cool episode. We're going to be catching up with Rafi Fisher, who's one of the VPs over at Orcam. Orcam is the creator of a very cool accessory called the My Eye, and we're going to get a preview into the My Eye 2, which is a great device that you can clip onto your glasses to help reading pretty much anything.
Very good. Sounds like an interesting episode. Mark, thank you for making time for us today, and here's hoping for always a very enthusiastic Apple Unleashed event today.
I will see you there.
Maybe they can even drag Steve Ballmer and be like, Steve, we're letting you cross the aisle. Let's hear your enthusiasm for us. That's Mark Aflalo. He's the co-host of Double Tap TV. He joined us from Montreal. Coming up after the break, we'll catch up with Daniel Panamondo for the Entertainment Report. Nazreen Abdel-Majid will be here for What's Trending. I've got your accessibility story roundup. Mike Ross will be here with This Day in History, the Now of Then. And we'll look ahead to this afternoon when Kelly and Company hits the airwaves with Ramya Amuthan. So, what's your excuse for not sticking around for 2 minutes? Because now with Dave Brown, we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Everybody is standing by and waiting to offer their mini segment. But you know who goes first? It's me with the accessibility story roundup. Hee-haw! This one coming to us from a blog post on the Mind's Eye website. Audio described Cardinals baseball debuted in 2021. So our friends over at Mind's Eye, an organization that offers live description for cultural and sporting events in the U.S., described over 60 home games for the St. Louis Cardinals at Busch Stadium this year. A couple games of note, July 25th, the Cardinals and the Pirates, game for participants of the SOAR program at Lighthouse for the Blind St. Louis. The SOAR program, which is the Summer Orientation and Mobility Adapted Living Resource Program, is a highly intensive structured residential training program that provides specialized instruction to youths aged 16 to 21 who are legally blind. Then some more folks got a chance to take part in the live described action on August the 6th, the Cardinals and the Royals game for the SWKIA and SEKIA through Lighthouse for the Blind St. Louis. These are recreational developmental groups for individuals who are aged 8 to 18 who are blind and visually impaired and reside in southwest and southeast Missouri. And then on August 22nd, the Cardinals and the Pirates game was described for the Braille Brilliance Group from the Lighthouse for the Blind St. Louis. The Braille Brilliance program provides students and families with the goal-focused Braille tutoring and opportunities to connect with other Braille readers through fun-related activities. And students had a chance to fill out tactile scorecards during the game. Not a lot of commentary to offer here, just another great example of the guys at Mind's Eye doing incredible work in regards to giving people from the blind and low vision community in the St. Louis area an opportunity to take part in interesting cultural events. And this is a neat way to do it. And of course, baseball is one of those sports that people love, and there's always some interesting described video on the television side, but to offer it in the stadium, super, super cool, and to see Mind's Eye partnering with a couple of those local programs as well, really, really neat. So happy snaps and happy claps today for our friends down at Mind's Eye, and we should get Jason Frazier, their CEO, on the show sometime again soon and talk a little bit about their amazing work, and as always, sneak in a little bit of wrestling talk. Let's bring in Daniel Benamondo for the Entertainment Report. So, Daniel, what's going on in the world of entertainment this morning?
A couple quick stories for you. I mentioned, I mean, look, we're talking about Adele again.
That's okay. We can talk about Adele all you want. We could talk about Adele every day. We could rename the show Now with Adele, and I'd be okay with it.
I mean, look, when the biggest music of the year drops, you spend a few segments talking about
it. Heck yeah, you do.
But what did I say last week, Dave? I said RIP to Drake's Certified Lover Boy records, and every other artist for that matter. And that is the case, because the reaction to Adele releasing a single from her forthcoming album has been enormous. Spotify confirms her song Easy on Me, her new song, has become its most streamed song in a single day when it was released on Friday. Now, Amazon Music also confirms that Easy on Me received the most first-day Alexa song requests in Amazon Music history. Interestingly, though, neither company wanted to give specific numbers, just the accolades.
Why would they? Because they can just say whatever they want whenever they want.
Sure. So just the accolades, no specific numbers. And, of course, the album 30 comes out November 19th, as we've already mentioned. So there you go. She's doing quite well. Hasn't missed a step.
So I definitely was part of that multiple streaming. So I know you and I both streamed it before the show yesterday, so we could offer a little commentary on it. And then after the show, on my walk to the liquor store, I also listened to it a few more times. It's a really good song. Yeah. It's a really, really good song.
Yeah, I mean, nothing much more to say about it. Like, she hit it out. I mean, it's great. I agree with you. I contributed my handful of listens as well on Spotify.
You know what it is, though? Like, there was a lot of anticipation going into that song, and sometimes the lack of moderation of expectations means you're going to be disappointed in the content.
Right.
This was a case where it was highly anticipated, expectations were high, and she absolutely hit it out of the park. And I can't wait to hear the rest of the record.
That's a good point, too. You're right about the expectations, but has she ever misfired on a single? I can't think of any. Like, all of her singles are great. Like, I love them. And many people do. So she keeps that trend rolling of her knocking it out of the park.
Yeah,
now, next up, we're talking, I don't know if you saw this, but the Batman trailer, the new Batman trailer that came out on the weekend, Warner Brothers has unveiled its trailer for The Batman, which features Robert Pattinson's first bone-crunching turn as a DC comic superhero. The trailer unveiled on Saturday at the DC FanDome event shows Pattinson's Dark Knight methodically taking down bad guys despite being outnumbered and his batsuit absorbing multiple bullets. The footage teases a dark, bleak, and violent version of Batman. Wasn't that the last version?
Yeah, wasn't that the last trilogy? Wasn't that the Nolan trilogy?
Maybe a little bit darker.
Darker,
maybe a tinge
and
darker.
Bleaker.
With Pattinson's voice.
Oh, Daniel, I think we just walked into a trap there.
What?
Because the Ben Affleck version was the most recent version.
Yes.
But are we just going to forget that existed? Are we just going to wipe that off?
But he did not get a solo. Did he get a solo movie? He didn't get a solo
Batman
movie.
Batman versus Superman and like Justice League.
Right.
I don't know. I don't care. They were terrible.
Yeah, we're talking about Christian Bale, of course.
Let's just pretend the Ben Affleck ones didn't happen. And we'll just focus on maybe the three best superhero movies ever made, the actual Batman trilogy.
Which one is your favorite out of those three? I'm curious.
I like the first one. I like Batman Begins.
Interesting. And it was pointed out, everyone's making this big hoopla about how young Robert Pattinson is. And he is young. He's a young actor. But I'm hoping this is true because I didn't fact check it, but someone pointed out that Robert Pattinson is in fact older now, starring in his first Batman movie, than Christian Bale was in Batman Begins.
Okay.
So it's like, you know, there goes that point. But anyways, Zoe Kravitz, Catwoman, Colin Farrell as the Penguin, which I remember hearing about the casting of that, and I watched the trailer, and I couldn't even recognize Colin Farrell, which is amazing. He looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see the Batmobile, all that. The Batman will be released March 4th. What did you think of the new trailer, though?
I think it made me not excited for the movie at all.
Interesting.
Like, at all. Some of the initial commentary on this film when it was in production and development was that it was going to be much more of the hard-boiled detective-style story, that it was going to be Batman the detective as opposed to Batman the superhero. Mm. And all I saw in this trailer was just, oh, big fight scenes! Yeah. And it's like, I don't care, man. I think, sorry, this is going to sound like Dave Brown's greatest hits. We need to stop it with the perpetual repeating of intellectual property every 3 years. Give me 10 years or 15 years in between to kind of like redigest and like refocus. I like Robert Pattinson. I think he's a really good young actor. I typically have enjoyed a lot of the Batman movies over the years, but I just like, I've got no enthusiasm for it. None. I'm just done with it.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's, if I'm not mistaken, it's more specifically a DC problem. Like, Marvel has it pretty, like, set with their kind of cast, as it were,
right
now.
Yeah, but even Marvel, it's the same movie over and over again.
Fair enough.
Sorry.
Hot take with Dave.
Sorry, apologies.
I mean, I think it looks all right. I mean, I didn't even see any of the Affleck movies. I saw, you know, I enjoyed the Christian Bale ones. I can't even trust my own word when I say I'll see something in a movie. I still haven't seen No Time to Die, and I was, like, so excited for that. What happened
all
to the excitement,
Dave? All you did was talk about James Bond for, like, 3
That's
years.
That's true. It was delayed. I was upset. It was delayed and delayed, and here I am. I still haven't seen it. What's wrong with me? I have no idea.
We should go this week. We should go one afternoon. Maybe. Tell your wife and the mother-in-law, like, extra baby. Babysitting duties for them, and because Dan and Dave got to go see a movie.
Sounds good. Sounds
all
good,
right,
Dave.
Making plans on the air. You can't say no either, because then you make me look bad on the air. Daniel, thank you for this.
You're welcome, Dave.
That's Daniel Panamondo with the Entertainment Report. Let's bring in Nasreen Abdelmajid to find out what's trending. Nasreen, you have a couple hashtags for us today.
Yeah, but at least join me in earlier so I'm invited too. But aside from that,
wait. In regards to the Batman,
yeah,
chats.
Yeah, I'll invite myself.
Okay, listen. You want to come to the Batman movie? Okay, yeah, come on in.
Yeah. I'm
we
there.
Can rent the theater and have an AMI screening for all the AMI employees. How about that?
That sounds cool.
Everyone's invited.
I like that.
So one of Canada's top trends is hashtag Small Business Week. We celebrate all you small business owners who made it through a challenging time during the pandemic. And I had to bring this up because so many small business owners struggled these past 2 years, actually. So it's really great. It's really hard to start a business. So I know, I understand how it is. So this is a week to celebrate, not just this week, but every week. So I wanted to move on to the second trend, and it's Person's Day. October 18 is Person's Day in Canada. It marks the day in 1929 when the historic decision to include women in the legal definition of persons was handed down by Canada's highest court of appeal. This gave some women the right to be appointed to the Senate of Canada and paved the way for women's increased participation in public and political life. Though this decision did not include all women, such as Indigenous women and women of Asian heritage, and it did mark critical progress in the advancement of gender equality in Canada. According to the Government of Canada in 1927, five women who have since become known as the Famous Five. So if you did look on Twitter and they all talked about the Famous Five, here are the Famous Five, launched a legal challenge that would mark a turning point for equality rights in Canada. There is Emily Murphy, Nellie McClung, Louise McKinney, Irene Parlby, and Henrietta Muir Edwards were journalists, politicians, reformers, activists from Alberta who asked the Supreme Court of Canada to answer the following question. Question is, does the word person in Section 24 of the BNA Act include female persons? After 5 weeks of debate, the Supreme Court still decided that the word person did not include women, and they did not give up. So on October 18, 1929, Lord Sankey, Lord Chancellor of Great Britain, announced the decision, quote unquote, "The exclusion of women from all public offices is a relic of days more barbarous than ours, and to those who would ask why the word person should include females, the obvious answer is, why should it not?" End quote. And there's a brief summary of all of it. So There you go.
Legal history with Nisreen Abdel-Majid. Pretty wild when we talk about how old our democracy is and how great our democracy is when it wasn't even 100 years ago that half of the population couldn't vote. That'll tell you something right there about the way in which we think about democracy as a tradition. When people talk about 1776 or they talk about 1862, 1867, they talk about all these dates and all these wonderful foundings of North American democracy, oldest democracies in the world, inclusive voices. 100 years ago, more than half the population could not even vote. Nisreen, thank you for this.
Thank you.
That's Nisreen Abdel-Majid with What's Trending. Let's bring in Mike Ross to find out what happened this day in history, the now of then.
Thanks, Dave. We'll begin October 18th, 1919. Pierre Elliott Trudeau was born. He taught law in Montreal, became a Liberal MP in 1965, and would eventually become Prime Minister have a legacy that included the Official Languages Act, the repatriation of the Constitution, along with the addition of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. He remained in office until his retirement in 1984, except for a brief period when the Conservatives and Joe Clark held power in 1979/80. As you heard from Nisreen, 1929, the Privy Council of Britain reversed the decision of the Supreme Court of Canada, ruling that Canadian women were persons and could become senators. And that decision led to the appointment of Corrine Wilson as the first female member of the upper house. And on this day in 1968, the first ever live telecast from a manned U.S. spacecraft was transmitted from Apollo 7. And those are your events and happenings this day in history.
Thank you very much, Mike. Let's head over to catch up with Ramya Amuthan to find out what's coming up today on Kelly & Company. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Good morning, Dave.
So the show, It's the Airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. What are you guys cooking up for this program?
Well, we start off every week with Brock Richardson of the Neutral Zone giving us our sports update to kick off things. Then we're talking to Jillian Gillis, our newest AMI reporter in Halifax, and she's previewing tonight's episode of AMI this week, right? But the feature is Sheila Shenanigans, a legally blind drag queen in Nova Scotia, a really prominent one as well. So super excited to learn about that. And we're talking about Youth Climate Action Day. This is a worldwide movement of young people who are concerned about climate change and global injustice. And this year it's falling on Saturday, October 23rd. And what we're doing on Kelly and Company is we've invited contributors and guests to speak on climate action and climate change and all of these different things about climate awareness throughout the week leading up to Youth Climate Action Day. So that's what we're kicking off today also.
Very good. That's a great conversation. We know that when we're discussing any action on climate change, it's a multi-pronged approach where multiple perspectives have to be considered. So it's great to hear you guys are really capturing that one. And Sheila Shenanigans, that is a great stage name for a drag queen. I like that
one. I think so too.
back in the day when I was in the theater side of things doing the occasional performance, one of the makeup artists may have picked the wrong color foundation for me and sort of turned my face very, very orange, which then spawned the conversation that if I ever did become a drag queen, I would be known as Sweet, Sweet Tangerine.
Oh, well, that's pretty good. It's still up for grabs then?
I don't know if it's still up for grabs. I haven't done much research on this, and I don't think there's going to be too many opportunities for a drag queen Dave Brown anytime soon. So I'm going to leave that to the experts. Right. Nobody needs that kind of amateur hour from me. Ramya, thank you for this. Have a great show.
Thanks, Dave.
Coming up next, we'll catch up with Jim Crisco. He'll tell you all about an inclusive playground in High River, Alberta. You're listening to Now with Sweet, Sweet Tangerine on AMI. It's actually Dave Brown. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's catch up with AMI content development specialist Jim Crisco for the Western Regional Report. Jim joins us this morning from Edmonton, Alberta. Hey, good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Jim, just before we jump into the topics at hand, it's Municipal Election Day in Alberta. What's the level of excitement today for the municipal elections?
Well, it's, you know, always exciting, Dave, like whenever you have an election.
When you get to talk about municipal politics, everyone gets fired up.
Absolutely. But it is a big one in Alberta because we have so much changeover in our mayors. We have something like 17 new mayors will be on board because there's mayors not coming back to run again. And that includes Edmonton, Calgary, Lethbridge. So we literally don't know who our mayors are going to be until tomorrow. Wow. It is a big election.
Wow. Some of the biggest cities in the province going to be dealing with some significant changeover today. So it's one, I'll look forward to for sure. Hey, Jim, let's stay in Alberta for both of our stories today. And we'll start in High River. There's an effort to develop an inclusive playground at the Dr. Morris Gibson School. So who's behind this, this idea?
Well, this is a really cool story. First of all, as you know, Dave, we always bring up whenever there's new inclusive playgrounds being built, I like to bring them up if I'm made aware of them, because it's such a an important thing for the community, such a big thing for the community. And this, I've got this from High River Online, if you want to follow up more on it. But what it is it, this was truly a grassroots effort by students. There was a student named Ella Cutting, and she actually made a presentation to her class about accessibility at the playground because her friend Cooper Oaks is a wheelchair user, and Ella didn't believe that the playground was accessible enough. And it was after that where another wheelchair user, Bentley, her friend Gabby Wildman, decided to get on board with the project as well. And these kids started the fundraising with their families to raise money for the park. So, I mean, it doesn't get any more pure and any more grassroots than that.
Yeah.
When it's coming from the children.
Yeah, that's it. Identifying the needs of their friends and saying, guys, you have to step up and be more inclusive to ensure that these spaces are for everybody. So, Jim, you mentioned there's a fundraising component. How's that going so far? How much money have they raised?
They raised $50,000 within a few months this
year.
It went extremely well. And then the Kiwanis got on board, and it's just going to grow from there. And, you know, what's really key, what's really important, keep in mind that we always point out when these playgrounds open, is these are truly playgrounds for everyone, for all the children. So they're not playgrounds made especially for children with maybe mobility challenges. However, they can be used by all the kids. So it is as inclusive as it gets on the playground.
So, Jim, as you mentioned, we talk about inclusive playgrounds a lot on this show and on your segments because, as you identify, it's really good. It's great for the community, bringing people together and eliminating stigma. So what are some of the things they want to do to make this playground particularly inclusive?
Well, they're adding more and more inclusive equipment as it goes along. But what they're doing is they're also putting in the rubberized flooring. So, you know, taking out whether it be sand or whether it be wood chips or whatever they had before. Now it's rubberized so that it becomes completely accessible. They're adding ground level playground equipment. They're upgrading. They want to upgrade to a disc swing in the future. They have a merry-go-round that's ground level for children in wheelchairs or wheelchair users. So, they clearly, and also, you know, what's really clear too is the design of this playground equipment has come a long way in the last few years, and there's so much more accessible equipment. So now they're having to choose what they're putting into the playground as time goes on.
So as you mentioned, it's a bit of an ongoing project. Do they have a sense of when it might actually be, quote, completed?
Well, you know, that's interesting because they do have, it is open now. There's parts of it open now, but they're already talking about phase two. So there's more equipment that they want. Phase one is open. You can go and enjoy it right now, but they're already planning for phase two, and who knows, maybe a phase three after that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the time frame on the phase two is. However, they really, really got the ball rolling and were quite quick on the first phase. So that was really encouraging.
Well, Jim, let's jump over from the world of inclusive playgrounds to the world of documentary, because a documentary called Blind Ambition, the story of Wap Mae, received a jury award at the Edmonton International Film Festival. So let's jump off from this point. Who was Wilfred Wap Mae?
Wilfred Wap Mae was a famous historic pilot out of Edmonton, out of Alberta, and I'll tell you one of his exploits, Dave, and he's had many, many exploits. He was a young pilot in World War I just learning how to fly a plane. He was sent out with a squadron to not engage. He wasn't supposed to engage, but he was sent out with a squadron to observe a dogfight with German flyers. He ended up getting into a dogfight with the Red Baron, and he was a brand new pilot. So when the Red Baron, what happened was he engaged the Red Baron's brother or cousin or something, a relative up in the sky. The Red Baron saw this and came after him. So Wilfred went as low as he could and started to fly along the treetops because he was a bush pilot. And the Red Baron went after him. Another pilot named Roy Brown, who was another Canadian pilot, saw this and came to the rescue of Wilfred Watt May. And it's inconclusive whether he shot down the Red Baron, but he did shoot the Red Baron. And then they believe now it's believed that maybe ground fire took him down. But he actually was in on the taking down the Red Baron from World War One.
Wow. Wow. So who's the director behind this documentary?
Well, there's a couple of gentlemen that have made the documentary. Frederick Croach is one. And Tom Robinson is the other. And Frederick has made other work for AMI, actually. There was The Last Fur Trader was a documentary.
Part of the family.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Frederick's a great filmmaker. And they did the way they made this documentary was it was archival footage, but they also did a lot of recreation, the reenactments in 35 millimeter film. It looks fantastic. It looks like a movie. And so it's really an interesting story. And what makes it really, really relevant is at a certain point in his flying career, Wilfred May lost vision in one of his eyes. He actually was blind in one eye, and he continued to fly. And it wasn't only a while later, a couple of years or a few years later, where in a medical exam they found out he was blind in one eye and they grounded him. But he actually flew that way for the longest time, and he was just such a remarkable pilot that no one knew.
Yeah. As mentioned, the documentary did win some recognition at the Edmonton International Film Festival, or EIF. Doesn't quite sound as good as TIFF, I'm just saying. what categories did it receive recognition?
You know what? I read that this morning and I thought the same thing. I can't say EIF.
EIF?
He won an EIF.
Yeah. EIF does sound better than EIF. So they beat me on that front.
He won the jury award for best documentary short film in Alberta. So, a prestigious award, always some really big, excellent competition in that category. So it's great to see that story is coming forward. He also, within the documentary is Denny May, who is Watt May's son, who we interviewed. When I was still a videographer editor here for AMI, we interviewed him as well. But Denny had just passed away just before the premiere at the film festival, just the day before, I believe, the premiere. And that was very recent. That was only a few weeks ago. So a very, honestly, a very, very interesting man, and had great stories talking about his dad and his dad's flying.
Jim, it sounds like you really enjoyed the documentary. Is there an opportunity for this to be found online or more widely available for folks? I mean, especially after winning the award, I imagine there's got to be some plans to get this onto more eyes and ears.
Yes, right now you can, I believe if you go to the EIF website, I believe it's there till maybe the end of the month or closer to. They are going to be playing it at the Edmonton or the Alberta Aviation Museum. So they actually made it for the Aviation Museum because there's some of Watt May's planes are there. And beyond that, I think that, you know, there's a chance it's going to be broadcast or at least be up on a streaming service in the future. But we don't know exactly where yet.
Very good. Hey, Jim, just before we let you go, yes, it is indeed Municipal Elections Day in Alberta, but it was also the Battle of Alberta on the weekend. How good does it feel to beat the Calgary Flames early in the year as an Edmonton Oilers fan?
You know, it feels so good, Dave. And I was talking about this with my son just before the game. It's like you don't even care where you are in the league or in the standings. You have to beat Calgary. That's just kind of the watermark here.
That's what Montreal fans feel about Toronto, Boston, and Ottawa. It really doesn't matter what's going on. If you can win those season series, then the entire season can be called a success. Hey, Jim, thank you for this. We always appreciate catching up. Thank you for giving us a slice of life out of Alberta this morning.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great week.
That's Jim Crisco. He's a content development specialist for AMI, speaking to us from Edmonton, Alberta. That's all the time we have for the show today. Don't worry. We'll be back again tomorrow. We're not going anywhere. We'll be joined by Joanne Pack, who discusses her upcoming talk on accessible graphic novels at the upcoming hashtag A11YTO conference. So looking forward to catching up with Joanne and having that conversation. And of course, it's Tuesday, which means the weekly news quiz will be happening. Nelson Rago will be here from Cool Blind Tech. Always a fun show on a Tuesday. Don't miss it. It starts at 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI TV, AMI Audio, AMI.ca. So until then, I'm Dave Brown reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.